It is Sunday, April 17th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, I'll speak to a representative of the Red Cross about the international response to Ecuador's deadliest earthquake in decades. We'll also hear from a geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey about what made Saturday's 7.8 magnitude quake so destructive in Ecuador and how it compares to another deadly quake that shook southern Japan on the same day. And we'll tell you about one final tour that an American country music legend is about to make. It's all ahead on International Edition. The death toll from a powerful earthquake in Ecuador surged to 238 on Sunday as daylight aided rescue and recovery efforts from the overnight devastation. More than 1,500 people are reported injured. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies has already started mobilizing resources to help the Ecuadorian government cope with the disaster. Earlier, I spoke by phone with the Federation's regional coordinator, Walter Cotti, in Panama City. I asked him how much help Ecuador needs from the international community.
On that point, the position of the Red Cross is we are following the national disaster system and the capacity of the country that is important, is very well prepared. And we have also a good national society there. The Ecuadorian Red Cross is a very strong national society. Of course, any kind of situation immediately causes the effect of overloading the system, and we need to help them. We are now in the process to create real understanding of the needs of each one of the lines that are required, and we are in permanent contact with the government and especially with the National Society of Ecuadorian Red Cross. And for me, there are some important needs, but now the concentration is in disaster response quickly and focus on search and rescue and coordination and evaluation management to bring things that are highly required immediately. We are doing a quick evaluation. People is in the ground now, supported and working together with the National Society and with the government. We already have some generic ideas of the needs, but we need to precise and to work very clearly in the definition of concrete areas of focus for us in the operation. This is the process that we have now. Meanwhile, we are helping on the search and rescue operation.
Well, what specific support can the Red Cross provide for search and rescue?
We have teams in the National Society that are very well prepared. We already sent a team from Mexico. This is in their way to Ecuador in a charter. And we also are sending people by land and by plane from Colombia to Ecuador in order to help them. They are also receiving other groups from other entities, but Red Cross is by now managing search and rescue from Colombia and from Ecuador, and maybe we have on the queue Costa Rican Red Cross. They have very good preparation for that, and we are ready to support with our network in the region. We also have a health teams ready to be deployed, and we have some support on water sanitation already on their way inside Ecuador. They are going to, in this moment, they are traveling in Ecuador to get there in the region.
Well, what would you say are the biggest challenges facing the Red Cross workers in Ecuador now?
I think that the challenges are the same for everyone. First, is to be able to coordinate well the efforts of search and rescue, to put very quickly capacity to support and to give complementary resources to the government and to the national entities. And we need to describe better and well the needs in each one of the territories. There are at least six provinces very highly affected, three of them with a lot of situations of destruction in municipalities, municipal buildings, and also houses. We are checking all the instruments that are available to have a kind of common vision of the problem, and then supporting in concrete in a specific matter that are required.
Well, what kind of longer-term support do you think Ecuador will need from the international community?
I mean, in general, in each case when you have an earthquake, you need to building back the capacity that they used to have, and if it's possible, and this is the idea that we have in the Red Cross, to improve the capacity of absorption and allow them be more resilient than in this moment. They have some a big level of resilience, but we need to improve this level as the situation requires. And I think we are going to prepare a very important lines in our, at least in the Red Cross position. We are focused on, for me, the recovery of things like water, sanitation, and basic health capacities, and the networking among the communities to help them to grow and to make actions that make them more able to absorb and to work on their own recovery.
Okay, well, thank you very much to Walter Conte with the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, speaking to Voice of America from Panama City.
Thanks, sir. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, let's turn to our social media segment and International Editions. Giabi Lee is with me in the studio to tell us about the online community's reaction to this tragedy. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
Well, in terms of that online reaction, some of it's coming from the tweets of the Ecuadorian president, who's quite prolific, isn't he?
He is, and his handle is at Mashi Rafael. That's M-A-S-H-I, Rafael with an F.
And what was he tweeting today?
He's updating the death toll and sharing his gratitude for the international community's support. He tweets in Spanish, obviously, but Twitter lets the users to see the translation, in my case, into English. One of his latest tweets reads like this: "The whole country is mobilized thanks to the international community for solidarity."
Well, what other Twitter accounts can people follow to keep up to date on the situation in Ecuador?
The U.S. Geological Survey has an account solely dedicated to earthquake alerts, and that handle is at USGSTED. And the tweets are without the bells and whistles of infographics and videos, so he typically just sends out information on the size and location of an earthquake and also the time it was detected.
Great, and I'm actually going to speak to a U.S. Geological Survey expert in just a moment after the next break.
Great.
What is the response like to this earthquake from the U.S. presidential contenders?
So there hasn't been a tweet from the three Republican contenders, but both of the Democrat contenders sent out tweets. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders wrote, "We express our condolences and solidarity with the people of Ecuador and Japan as they recover from these devastating earthquakes." Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton also wrote, "Our hearts go out to the people of Ecuador and the families who lost loved ones from yesterday's earthquake," and signed it H. She also sent out another tweet in Spanish that means the same. Now, some people actually pointed out in one of the replies that writing Twitter translates, so no need for two tweets. But on the flip side, I'm pretty confident more than 1,200 people who liked the tweet in Spanish appreciated that version. In related news, Secretary of State John Kerry also expressed his condolences on Twitter, adding that Washington is ready to assist and support the Ecuadorian people in this difficult time. That tweet received about 1,200 likes as well. Michael?
Okay, so a lot of sympathy there coming from U.S. officials. Thank you very much to Giabi Lee for that roundup. You can follow G on Twitter at Giabi Lee, and she tweets for the VOA IE account, whose handle is at VOA underscore IE. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at Michael underscore Lippin. This is VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palkov.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. Back now to the earthquake in Ecuador. I spoke by phone today to Jessica Turner. She is a geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Golden, Colorado. I began by asking her what made Saturday's quake so deadly for the South American nation.
There are a couple of things that made this earthquake destructive. Number one is the magnitude. At magnitude 7.8, pretty much anywhere near a big city is going to cause some sort of damage. It was right off the coast of Ecuador near the city of Musine. I have no idea how to pronounce that, but it's right there on the coast of Ecuador. So being a large magnitude near a populated area and also being of shallow depth, meaning it was close to the surface, caused all the damage and fatalities that we are seeing with this earthquake.
So how common are such powerful quakes in Ecuador and, you know, the surrounding area?
Earthquakes in Ecuador do happen quite often because it is located in a thrust area, meaning that the Nazca plate is going underneath the South American plate, and these large subduction areas cause large earthquakes. This area has seen earthquakes from time to time. Looks like in January of 1906, there was a magnitude 8.3 earthquake very close to where yesterday's earthquake occurred. And so it's not uncommon to see earthquakes of this size in this part of the world.
Well, what kind of aftershocks have there been from this magnitude 7.8 in Ecuador? And what other aftershocks are you expecting there to be in this area?
Like I said, this earthquake was shallow. And with large, shallow earthquakes, we do expect to see aftershocks lasting days to maybe weeks, even months. It's kind of hard to predict. But as of this moment, we have located around 10 aftershocks, ranging in magnitude from 4.5 on up to magnitude 5.4, which is very, very normal to see from a magnitude 7.8 shallow earthquake. We do expect, I wouldn't say expect, but we wouldn't be surprised to see a magnitude below that as an aftershock. So if it's a magnitude 7.8, we wouldn't be surprised to see a magnitude of 6.8 aftershocks in this sequence.
Well, how much more powerful was the Ecuador quake compared to the quake in southern Japan, which happened on the same day?
The magnitude 7.8 earthquake that occurred in Ecuador is about 6 times bigger than the magnitude 7 earthquake that happened in Japan a couple days earlier.
Well, what was distinctive about the earthquakes in southern Japan, in the Kyushu island?
What's distinctive about those is that we haven't seen this size of magnitude earthquake in this area of Kyushu, Japan, in the past 100 years. So the size of the magnitude is probably the most distinctive. And also, again, it happened right underneath a major population center of the city of Kumamoto. When a large shallow earthquake occurs underneath a big city like that, you are going to see a lot of damage and fatalities from an earthquake that size.
And what was the cause of those earthquakes in Kyushu, and how does that cause differ from the nature of the Ecuador quake?
Okay, so the earthquake in Ecuador, as I said, was a subduction earthquake where one tectonic plate is going underneath another tectonic plate. The earthquake that occurred in Kyushu, Japan, was not subduction, which we kind of associate with Japan, but it was a strike-slip fault, which means two parts of the earth were kind of gliding past one another. There wasn't any plate motion going underneath another plate. So the strike-slip motion is different than the going underneath another plate motion, and that's how these two earthquakes differed.
Well, thank you very much to Jessica Turner, a geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Thanks for speaking to VOA's International Edition.
Thanks for having me. And if you do have any more questions, our website at earthquake.usgs.gov has plenty of information.
Well, turning now to U.S. politics, the race for the Republican presidential nomination is heating up. Frontrunner and businessman Donald Trump suffered a setback this weekend, with his rival, U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, winning all the delegates on offer in the U.S. state of Wyoming. Our Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joined me in the studio a short while ago to tell me what Cruz's strategy is going forward.
What Ted Cruz is doing, because let's be honest, it's highly unlikely that he is going to win that absolute majority of delegates. The math isn't in his favor.
Given that he's so far behind.
Exactly. And we're running out of states and time for him to catch up. What he can do is he can try to siphon off as many delegates as possible, those that are uncommitted, or even those who are committed to voting for Trump in the first round of balloting. But if Trump should fall short, the rules state that delegates afterwards are free to vote as they choose. And that's where Cruz thinks that he could win the nomination.
Well, he wants even those delegates who are bound to vote for Trump in the first round of a convention to actually be his supporters, doesn't he? Because if they're his supporters, you know, as soon as they can vote their conscience, right?
Exactly, Mike. In the first round, delegates have to vote according to the results of the state from which they come. But after that, there could be someone who is bound to vote for Trump in the first round but could vote for Cruz thereafter. Donald Trump has gotten wind of this, obviously, and he's not happy about it. He's done a number of things. First of all, he's complained that Republicans are trying to stack the deck against him, but he's also been hiring a number of party operatives, people who have been in the trenches in this kind of battle before and who can help him try to sew up delegates.
Well, why can't Donald Trump ensure that those delegates who are bound to vote for him in the convention are actually his supporters?
Well, he doesn't get to choose the delegates. State party conventions typically choose these delegates. And in fact, Ted Cruz went to the Wyoming State Party convention just this past Saturday and assured that 14 of the delegates up for grabs that were at stake at that convention were all his backers. He went there personally. He spoke to them. And the people that he favored were chosen to be delegates, all 14 of them. Donald Trump isn't the kind of candidate who goes to state party conventions and, you know, meets people one-on-one. He's much more sort of the macro campaigner. But he recognizes that his campaign has a big outreach that it needs to do. And that will be especially critical if there is more than one round of balloting.
So we could see maybe a shift of emphasis from Trump from the macro campaigner to the micro campaigner out of necessity, huh?
Yes, although I should say that, you know, on Tuesday is New York's primary. That is Donald Trump's home state. He could conceivably really clean up in delegates there, and that could propel him in other states. There are a lot of sort of northeastern, mid-Atlantic to northeastern states that are coming up. It's not inconceivable that Donald Trump could get to the 1,237 absolute majority. It's perhaps not the most likely, but it's absolutely not out of the question.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to VOA's Senate correspondent Michael Bowman for bringing us the latest on the Republican delegate fight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA is continuing its preparations for future manned voyages to deep space destinations such as Mars. One of the many issues they are addressing is the need for comfortable but efficient small living areas for astronauts while they're so far from Earth. NASA will be trying out a new module that, when fully deployed, will expand its compressed size of about 2 meters in length and diameter to about 4 meters. This new module is called the Bigelow Expandable Activity Module, or BEAM, and is scheduled for installation at the International Space Station on April 16th. According to NASA, the installation should take about 4 hours and will involve technicians from Mission Control in Houston and astronauts aboard the ISS. Astronauts will first go into the module about a week after expansion and will occasionally return over its 2-year test mission to retrieve data. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. American singer-songwriter Kenny Rogers has created some of the most influential albums in country music history. But in late September, Rogers announced his pending retirement from music and just released details of his final worldwide tour. For more on that, Nikki Strong of VOA Music spoke to International Edition's Sarah Williams.
So, Nikki, when does the tour kick off, and what does Kenny have planned for the show?
The tour is called The Gambler's Last Deal. It starts in May and goes through mid-November, but dates are still being added. They anticipate it will go into 2017. It begins May 13th in Minnesota. It cuts across the U.S., and then it hits the Philippines in August. And then it goes to Scotland, the Netherlands, Ireland, and England in the fall thus far. The show itself, he says, will be a retrospective covering his 50-plus year career. It'll include personal stories and photos and video clips. He'll be performing songs outside of his common set list. And he also said expect more of his comedy dialogues, too. And Grammy-winning country singer Linda Davis, who, by the way, is also the mother of Hillary Scott of Lady Antebellum, and Charlie Warsham will be his guest.
Well, many country artists perform well past retirement, so why has he decided to call it quits?
Well, it's still past retirement for him, but he decided to really call it quits, primarily to spend time, more time with his twin sons, who I think are about 12 years old now. He says, I've done everything I could do. He said, I've won everything I could win, and now my life has to go on. He also recently shared that he feels that today's country music is going in another direction, and he's not interested in competing.
Well, this notion of country music moving in another direction or away from its roots is an ongoing theme in the country music discourse.
Yeah, it is. Country music has always experienced a certain amount of pop success and crossover success, but pop music is changing. And as contemporary country artists endeavor to create crossover success, they're going to borrow from what's popular. So in addition to many current artists, they've also grown up on other musical influences and in different historical times than the older artist. But overall, though, I think the music is cyclical, and eventually people will turn to their roots to receive inspiration. So I think popular country music may start to have a more traditional aesthetic in the future. And there's definitely an audience for it.
And many in that audience will most likely catch Kenny Rogers on this tour.
Most definitely.
For more information on the Gambler's Last Deal tour, you can go to kennyrogers.com. You can also hear more traditional and contemporary country music on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA One. To reach Nikki, you can connect on Facebook at VOA Music or on Twitter at VOA_music. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
That's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
8 months ago, the leaders of South Sudan's two main warring parties, President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar, signed a peace agreement to end the conflict that for 20 months had devastated the young nation. Since then, progress on implementing the agreement has been far too slow, marked by delays and obstruction from both sides. South Sudan's conflict is nearly half as old as the country itself, having erupted in December 2013 during a power struggle between President Kiir and Machar, his former vice president. Fighting reopened ethnic fault lines between Kiir's Dinka and Machar's newer ethnic groups. Unknown thousands of people have been killed and more than 2.2 million driven from their homes, with many fleeing to neighboring states. The United States condemned recent actions by both sides in the Wau area. The actions by government troops were in clear violation of the permanent ceasefire provisions, which apply nationwide and were agreed to by all signatories of the peace agreement. Additionally, credible reports that the opposition and associated armed actors recently attacked government forces and civilians in the same area also represent a violation of the ceasefire. The United States condemns all such actions. Moreover, the United States has urged all parties to resolve disputes through dialogue. Disputes related to ceasefire implementation and cantonment should be referred to the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission and other relevant mechanisms outlined in the Agreement on the Resolution of the Conflict in the Republic of South Sudan. There is no military solution to the conflict in South Sudan. All parties must fulfill their commitments to implement the provisions of the peace agreement in full. This is the only way to heal the country, repair its ailing economy,